Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Housing and the White House on the program today. Oil prices have stopped falling for now. That is good for some. And a chat about art. Art that fits on the sides of buildings. It is big art. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 8th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody, as it always is. I'm going to give you a list to get us going today, all right? Three items, and you tell me, economically, which one is not like the other, all right? Here we go. Unemployment is number one, gross domestic product is number two, and housing is number three. So, let's see. Unemployment is coming right along, down under 6%. December numbers come out tomorrow morning, by the way. We'll tell you about that on the show tomorrow. GDP is up 5% annualized growth at last check. Housing, yeah, that's the one. The economic engine that is the building, buying, and selling of houses in this country simply is not firing on all cylinders. That explains why President Obama found himself in Phoenix, Arizona today, one of the areas hardest hit by the mortgage crisis, trying again to do something about housing. The White House wants to cut the interest rate on insurance for about 800,000 first-time mortgages and so make those mortgages just a little bit cheaper and more affordable. For the difficult-to-turn-around beast that is the American economy, though, of which housing is such an important part, is today's announcement a big enough deal? Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has that story.
The housing market is not Las Vegas. What happens there usually doesn't stay there. Sam Cater is an economist at CoreLogic.
Typically, the housing market leads the economy into and out of a recession.
But this time,
it led us into the recession. It has not helped us come out of the recession. It's been a laggard.
Fewer homes sold means fewer homes built, which means fewer jobs in construction and related industries. Recipe for a Vegas-style economic hangover, which is why Obama made an announcement today.
Starting this month, the Federal Housing Authority will lower its mortgage insurance premium rates enough to save the average new borrower more than $900 a year.
$900 may sound small, but Susan Wachter at the Wharton School says it looks big, viewed from the perspective of the hundreds of thousands of households looking to buy a home.
However, the big problem today is not the cost of funds.
Wachter says with interest rates at historic lows, it's already cheap to buy a house.
If you can get a loan, and that is the problem that's not addressed.
Wachter says it's still too hard to get a loan because the market overcorrected from the easy money of the financial crisis. Fixing that will require serious structural reform. But CoreLogic's Sam Cater says if you really want to kickstart the housing market, you need two things.
Jobs and raises. Real incomes have been the same for the last 25 years. And you can't underwrite your way out of stagnating incomes.
Cater says the housing market is extremely important to the country's recovery. But until the fundamentals of the economy improve, the housing market won't either. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
This week, an FDA panel recommended what could wind up being a multi-billion dollar change in the pharmaceutical business. It's about a class of drugs called biosimilars because they are, yes, similar to drugs that are made out of living cells, drugs known as biologics. The panel recommended unanimously that the FDA approve the first biosimilar drug in this country. The multi-billion dollar savings part comes when I tell you that biologics are some of the most expensive medications we have. From the healthcare desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has the story.
Biologic drugs are important. As the National Institutes of Health points out, they cover everything from wrinkles to rattlesnake bites, rheumatoid arthritis to cancer. And we pay a pretty penny for them, says Emory's David Howard.
A lot of the biologic drugs on the market sell upwards of $50,000 per patient.
Howard says some cancer biologics run over $100,000 a patient. The antidote to those prices is competition, which Howard says is exactly what biosimilars represent.
It could have a huge impact on spending on pharmaceuticals.
Nationwide, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars on these sorts of drugs. Sam Fazzelli from Bloomberg Intelligence says savings could range from 10 to 30%. Big numbers.
Again, this kind of competition is likely to eventually bring costs down, particularly to the payers and eventually to the patient.
One wild card is how physicians will feel about prescribing these biosimilars, drugs they just won't know. Historically, insurance companies haven't forced doctors to use specific medications, but there are more than 3,000 cancer drugs in the pipeline, many of them biologics. And Emory's David Howard says the thought of covering all those costs scares the bejesus out of insurers.
When you talk to these insurance companies, they think they are being, you know, ripped off. They think this is highway robbery, that they would very much like to have a tool at their disposal to reduce their spending.
Howard says the rise of new biosimilars may be just the tool they need. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street must have been drinking the happy juice today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The director of the FBI, James Comey, gave a speech yesterday in which he doubled down on the FBI's decision to name North Korea as the source of the cyber attack on Sony Pictures about a month or so ago. Kim Zetter writes on cybersecurity for Wired magazine. Kim, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back.
So, James Comey, the director of the FBI, said yesterday there is little doubt, those are his words, that the North Koreans pulled off the Sony hack. Why does he believe that?
Well, we still don't have all of the evidence and all the information that's backing his strong claim there, but he added a little new detail yesterday, and that he said the hackers made some sloppy mistakes, and in most of their activity, they used a proxy system or a proxy IP address in order to hide their real location and their real IP address, and in a few cases, they slipped up and they signed on to a Sony server and also made some posts online using an address that wasn't a proxy address. And he's saying that that IP address is known to be used exclusively by North Korea.
So we had you on, what, a month ago when the story first broke, plus or minus, right?
Yes,
And you were fairly confident that it wasn't the North Koreans. Are you still as confident?
I am. You know, here's the thing.
Sticking to your guns.
Let me backtrack a bit here.
Sure,
This is with the caveat that there's always the possibility that there actually is further intelligence, classified intelligence,
yes,
that gives
yes
us a much more definitive. If they have this other information, then yes, we can believe this. First of all, we don't know what this IP address is. We don't know what's connected to it. And we also don't know how they're saying that this is exclusively used by North Korea. And I'll tell you here what's the stickler here. There's still the issue of that initial communication from the hackers, which never mentioned the movie The Interview, and in fact appeared to be an extortion attempt to get money out of Sony. So until I can hear sort of a plausible explanation for why they would try to extort Sony instead of getting them to not show the movie, then there are always going to be these questions raised about what was the motive and whether or not North Korea was behind this.
Is it possible, on the theory that the FBI and the U.S. intelligence services will not release what they have, the intelligence they have to protect their sources and methods, is it possible that we, the general consuming public, may not ever know what actually happened?
It's very possible. I mean, most hacks, we don't ever really know. You know, we may never have a prosecution in this case, especially if it is nation state. So there's a good likelihood that we might never know. I did, however, see a story yesterday where the FBI has made a request to the government to unclassify all of the information around this so that they can disclose more.
Well, we'll see what happens with that. Quickly, just before I let you go, Kim, what do we know about what's going on over at Sony? I mean, are they still without computers? Are they in hack purgatory? What?
They're still struggling. We do know that. You know, after the hack, their network got taken down. Mm-hmm. They've had some problems restoring. And so what's happened is they're having to replace equipment. So this wasn't a matter of just data being destroyed. The master boot records on systems were destroyed, and that prevents the computer from booting up. So they're having to replace hardware, and they're still in the process of doing that.
All right. More to come on this story, I am sure. Kim Zetter, she is a reporter at Wired Magazine. She's also the author of a book called Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet, in the launch of the world's first digital weapon, which is sort of what we're dealing with here. Kim, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
The House of Representatives made a little change in the work week today, at least as far as healthcare goes. The definition of a full-time employee has bumped up from somebody who works 30 hours a week to somebody who works 40 hours. It matters because right now, a lot of people who clock 30 hours a week on the job are eligible for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. That is, their employers have to offer them health insurance. This change, which will, we have to say, likely be vetoed by the president should it get that far, would change that. Marketplace's Noel King has more on the story.
A 40-hour work week just seems right, right? Get in at 9, punch out at 5, or some version of that. But Benjamin Honeycutt, a professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa, calls the 40-hour work week a historical accident.
The almost universal expectation these days that 40 hours is somehow necessary, that Moses comes down off the Mount Ararat with the Ten Commandments and 40-hour week is part of it. No, that doesn't happen.
Until the mid-19th century, the typical American workday was dawn until dusk or even longer. But the Industrial Revolution started to change the kinds of jobs people were doing, says Angelica Santamaro, director of the American Labor Museum.
Mine workers were working so many hours in the mines, and eventually the factory workers and the mill girls were working, that their bodies just could not endure the 12-hour day, 5.5 days a week.
So under the umbrella of early unions like the American Federation of Labor, workers started calling for an 8-hour workday.
Asking for 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for what we will.
In 1938, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act and enshrined the 8-hour workday as the norm. Now, Republicans want to make 40 hours the norm for eligibility under the Affordable Care Act to make it easier for employers to avoid providing insurance. But for many workers, the 8-hour day is out of reach. In the most recent U.S. jobs report, nearly 7 million people said they are working part-time but would prefer a full 40 hours. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Before 1990, all the large billboards were all hand-painted. Most people don't know that.
Like me. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. The Dow Industrial's up 323 points today, 1.8%, closed at 17,907. The NASDAQ rose 85 points, also 1.8%, finished at 4736. The S&P 500 traded up 36 points. That is almost 1.8%. Finished the day at 2,062. Every stock in the Dow, by the by, was in the green today. Mid-sized oil producers are getting up off the mat. Investors bid up shares in Sanchez Energy Corp 7.5% today. Laredo Petroleum 8.75% to the plus side. The buzz continues that Yahoo ought to merge with somebody, maybe AOL. Shares in both up today. Yahoo up 3.33%. AOL 7.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its December jobs report. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and trade for November. And on January 9th, 1788, the Union grew to 5 states with the admission of Connecticut. Its state insect is the praying mantis, for those of you who keep track of that kind of thing. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the first things the new House of Representatives did on Tuesday after all the oaths were taken and hands were shaken was to do a little math, making a change that does, on the face of it, I will freely admit, sound a little bit wonky. House Republicans changed the rules on how major bills are scored. That is to say, the rules for what government economists consider when they figure out the costs of various pieces of legislation. Maybe, I don't know, a tax cut? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains the little change is going to come with some big effects.
You may stifle a yawn at the mention of dynamic scoring, but it's caused a sizzling debate in economic circles. Dynamic scoring is supposed to take into account all of the effects of a bill on the economy.
Something that the Congress should know.
Douglas Holtz Aiken was the chief economic advisor for Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. He says dynamic scoring helps members of Congress evaluate a bill. He supports the effort to move away from what we've been doing, static scoring, which doesn't look at a bill's impact on the overall economy.
If you have two identical proposals, but one causes the economy to grow and one causes it to shrink, you'd like to know that.
Not everybody agrees. Take Bruce Bartlett, a former economic advisor to President Reagan. He doesn't like dynamic scoring.
It's a very complicated process.
Bartlett says it forces economists to make assumptions about the future, which can highlight the economic benefits of, say, tax cuts. He says that's why House Republicans changed the rules to require government economists to use dynamic scoring.
By tying their hands and forcing them to make assumptions that will give them the answer they want, which is that tax cuts are vastly expansionary.
So, in principle, dynamic scoring is a perfectly reasonable technique.
That's our scorekeeper in this debate, Robert Polin. He teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He says the problem with dynamic scoring is you can pick and choose. Say, just look at the positive effects of a tax cut, people spending the extra money, not the possible negatives of lower government spending.
There's a wide range of potential effects, and so the technique is susceptible to this kind of cherry picking.
Polin says in principle, it's better to do dynamic scoring, but it's hard to do well and easy to manipulate. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Don't quote me on this, but it's entirely possible oil has found at least a temporary bottom. Crude has been bouncing around $48 or so a barrel for the past couple of days. That is after what could reasonably be called a precipitous drop in the second half of last year when oil was closer to $100 a barrel. For you and me and lots of other parts of the petroleum-using economy, that is good news. For energy producers, though, I'm thinking U.S. states here that have been big in the oil boom, it is not so good. It's not like booms and busts are a new thing in the American West, though. And in some states, like North Dakota and Wyoming, they continue to be a defining feature of the economy. Whether it has to be that way, though? From Wyoming Public Radio, here's Stephanie Joyce.
At the Cyclone Drilling offices in Gillette, Wyoming, brothers Patrick and Paul Ladke are arguing over who should talk to the reporter.
I do not wish to be on the radio. I mean that sincerely. My brother here.
The Ladke brothers are in surprisingly good spirits, given that it has not been a very good couple of months for them. Cyclone is one of the largest drillers in the state, but falling oil prices have forced them to start idling rigs. Paul Ladke says he's expecting a quarter of the company's rigs will be sidelined in 2015.
I'd feel fortunate if that was all that we see idling.
But Ladke is less worried about that than you might expect.
When you're in oil and gas, you realize that there's going to be highs and there's going to be lows, and you prepare yourself for the lows. If you're not prepared, you're not going to be in business very long.
That's a lesson states like Wyoming, North Dakota, and Alaska have taken to heart. These days, they all have sizable savings accounts for when prices drop. But a few decades ago, things were different, as author and journalist Samuel Western learned at a party several years back, when someone told him that at one point in the 1960s, Wyoming had just $100 in its bank account.
And I said, that's got to be apocryphal. That just can't happen. And yet, when I interviewed former Governor Stan Hathaway, it was not $100, it was $80 in the general fund. So I kind of said, how could that possibly be with all our mineral resources?
It was around that time that Wyoming started saving some of its mineral revenues to even out the cycle. But Western says those in power haven't forgotten that history and that the memory has shaped a survivalist mentality about the economy.
You become a stasher. You want to hide your money in coffee cans, and we still do that in Wyoming. We're still afraid we're just not going to have enough that we can survive. We won't go back to those old days again.
But Western says all the stashing just hides the underlying problem, that the economy of the state runs on one thing, minerals. 75% of Wyoming's revenues come from coal, oil, and natural gas. Western argues that getting out of the cycle takes more than saving and points to Texas, which back in the 1980s was almost as dependent on mineral wealth as Wyoming is today.
They've taken what they've done, exactly what I would hope society would do, take oil revenues and then build societies and industries and businesses that are not related to energy.
And it's not just Texas that's diversified. Stephen Brown is an economist at the University of Nevada who studied the impact of oil prices on state economies. He says virtually every state has become less dependent on mineral revenues since the oil crash of the 1980s.
What we're seeing is that states are becoming more and more alike and less driven by these boom and bust cycles.
But Brown says a few states still stand out for their reliance on minerals, Alaska and Wyoming being at the top of the list. Bill Schilling would like to see that change. He's the president of the Wyoming Business Alliance, which has its roots in the coal industry. He says energy has been a great thing for the state, paying for roads and schools, but also says the state needs other industries, especially now.
There are some clouds on the horizon.
But diversification is a tricky thing. And everyone interviewed for this story had a different excuse for why Wyoming hasn't managed that trick yet. The cold, the lack of people, the isolation. Even so, most, including Schilling, say it's clear that in states like Texas and Colorado, investing heavily in education helped.
We need people who can be programmers. We need people who can build things. We need manufacturing. I mean, we need all of those things.
And Schilling sees Wyoming heading down that path, albeit slowly. He points to state-sponsored scholarships and the expansion of the university's business school as positive developments. But he says more of that is needed.
What we are today is not going to be good enough for what we need to be tomorrow.
And with Wyoming's main economic drivers, coal, oil, and natural gas, all in a slump, tomorrow may be here sooner rather than later. I'm Stephanie Joyce for Marketplace.
You might have noticed in your drives around town, should you happen to live in a biggish city, or if not, maybe on TV, huge ads on the sides of some buildings. Not digital billboards or vinyl sheets with computer-printed graphics on them. Hand-painted art, literally as big as the side of a building. Wall dogs is the industry term for the people who paint those ads, because they usually are ads. It's also the name of a Los Angeles-based company that does that kind of thing here in town. Owner Riley Forsyth has been in the business of painting advertisements and billboards for 40 years now. Riley, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Let me get this straight. You and your guys jump off the sides of buildings to put up these advertisements. Is that basically it?
No, we don't jump.
Well, you repel, maybe.
No, we don't repel either. We use something like a window washer's rig.
Yeah.
It's attached very well to the top of the building, and there's no jumping or
and
repelling.
And you work your way down.
Yes.
All right. How does it work? A company comes to you and says, we want to put an ad up for XYZ, and you say, okay, we're going to do this, this, and this. What happens?
Well, they give us a scaled piece of artwork, and they also give me a digital file. That's the only thing that's actually digital about my business. We take that and we convert it into a large print. We grid it off.
Yeah.
We draw everything out by hand, panel by panel, the entire wall.
So somebody's face or a car or whatever the ad has in it.
Yeah. As we draw, we burn tiny little holes in it with an electric pencil. And then we take the paper out on location, roll it out on the wall, and we transfer the image through the holes in the paper onto the wall. Then we just take our gallons and buckets of paint up with us. We paint with rollers and brushes. We just start filling in the colors and blending them out.
How does one start in this business of getting these photorealistic, you know, ads and images up on a wall?
Well, before 1990, all the large billboards, including Los Angeles, were all hand-painted. Most people don't know that.
Huh.
All of us were trained to paint photorealistically, to reproduce the artwork as accurately as possible on these billboards.
At size, right? At scale.
At scale. We painted them on big wood panels in a shop downtown, and they would take them out with a truck and hang them up on these billboard structures. And about 1990, they developed a system much like a laser printer, except on a huge scale, that now they print them out on vinyl and stretch it out over these wood panels like a canvas.
Right, right.
Most of my guys are my age, and we're all old.
And you're a good-looking guy, but you're not 25 years old.
I'm not young, no.
Yeah.
So we've all kind of grew up in the billboard business. And
Do people have to submit portfolios to you to show that they can actually do this artwork on you know, building-size scale?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of people that apply for a job, but I can tell by looking at their material whether they can actually handle the photorealistic style or not.
It's not just L.A., though, where these ads and stuff go up on the side of buildings.
No. I mean, hand painting's been around all these years.
Yeah.
We've been doing it, but But there's always been this battle to try to replace us with a machine.
Sure.
So I think the hand-painting aspect of it is becoming more popular.
So we have right outside Marketplace World headquarters here, the 110 freeway runs right up and down the side of our building. Right?
Yes.
So if we wanted to get ourselves branded on the side of this building and engaged wall dogs, how much would we have to pay?
Well, the price of our things, you know, it depends on the size of the wall, and I think the largest one we paint is 230 feet tall.
Wow.
By 86 feet wide.
Ballpark it for me. $100,000?
No.
$50,000.
Around there.
All right. Well, yeah. I'll go to the corporate overlords and see what they say.
Cause, you know. Okay.
Riley Forsyth. His company is called Wall Dogs. You have seen, here in L.A. anyway, his work, and probably in other cities, similar stuff. Riley, thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of your car really is trying to kill you. Today, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA as it's known, announced its cumulative list of fines and civil penalties against automakers for the past year. The biggest, which was new today, in fact, and a record, is a $77.0 million fine to Honda for not reporting almost 2,000 death and injury claims to the federal government over the past 11 years. In all last year, NHTSA issued a total of $126 million in fines. That is also a record for the safety agency. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 323 points today, 1.8%. The NASDAQ kicked up 85 points higher, also 1.8%. The S&P 500 traded up 36 points, almost 1.8%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hearst, Cindy Johnson, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Mark Miller. You guys know my name. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.